All right, so in the interest of time, we'll introduce our first speaker. Our first speaker this morning is Bob Tipping. He's with the Minnesota Geological Survey. He's a senior scientist. His job is mostly a combination of applied research and outreach. His interests include groundwater surface water interaction, aquifer characterization, groundwater geochemistry, GIS applications to help address geologic and hydrogeologic problems, among many other things. And he'll be talking this morning about the County Atlas Program, and particularly Part G, which is the geologic setting. Good way, Bob.
All right, well, thank you. Good morning. So today's conference is about data, and what I wanted to do with this talk is to give you some background on Minnesota Geological Survey's contribution to data and groundwater management. I want to focus particularly on Part A's of the Geologic Atlas. I'll be followed by Todd Peterson, who will talk about Part B's. But specifically, what I want to do is I want to talk about physical setting. So I would like to talk about formats of data that are suitable for modelers and for planners, and give some examples of that from Washington County Geologic Atlas, which we're just completing in 2016. And then kind of what's going on next. So talking about heterogeneities within the units that we map. So within bedrock units, mapping fractures or changes in lithology. Within unconsolidated deposits, mapping heterogeneities between tills and sands and gravels. And then finally end up linking these Part A's to some other data sets that they apply to as examples. And then current Part A mapping status. So go ahead and get started. So what do I mean by physical setting? We're interested in getting data suitable for modelers and planners. And specifically, we want to map the extent. So USGS outlined in a report things that would be useful for these type of purposes. And one of them was mapping the extent and boundaries of upper and lower surfaces of aquifers and confining layers. This is something that we've been doing for a while now. And then in addition to that, the distribution of porosity and permeability within bedrock and unconsolidated deposits, and specifically mapping the spaces within rocks and sediment and aquifers and confining units. This is something that we're working on now. So what I'll show you are examples of where we have raster surfaces of tops and bottoms of units in the subsurface. And what we want to do is start to fill in those spaces. Information specifically about bedrock. So here's a strat plate from an earlier atlas. And this is one of the confining units shown here in brown, the St. Lawrence in the lower Jordan. And within the unconsolidated deposits, the focus of heterogeneities is mostly on texture. So the DNR is going to be using texture for mapping subsurface sensitivity. And this is how we're looking at right now, being able to realistically map subsurface heterogeneities in glacial deposits. Okay, so you get an atlas. This case, Washington County, it comes to you. It can get you on a CD-ROM, or you can get it from our website, but this format is similar. What we tried to do is to outline all the data in a GIS format that people can start using, and as part of that CD-ROM, an ArcMap project is set up like this, which is fairly interactive. In this case, we're going to look at the database plate, so it's one of the choices on the plate, and this is what it looks like. So here's the paper atlas. This is what we've been producing since 1982. So the first atlas that was constructed was Scott County, and then it became available in 1982, and these were paper products. So we still produce the paper products and the maps that have explanation that everything's on there, but we want to look at that in a little bit more detail. So here's the database plate. And this is Southern Washington County, and specifically we've got these features on there. So I want to walk you through some of these components and what they are. Hang on just a second. First thing, County Well Index. All right, the database. One of the things that we do with a geologic atlas, and probably one of the most valuable things that we do with the geologic atlas, is update the water well database. So this involves getting accurate locations for wells, and looking at the driller's description for some information about what the driller described, and then ultimately interpreting that. But first off, this issue of locating a well, this becomes really critical for any investigation that we know where that well is, and its X and Y, and also its elevation. Once we can do that, then we can start looking at interpreting that well. So here's the same log. First one was just the general report as described by the driller. In this case, we have the driller's log interpreted. And so what does that look like? Well, we've got this lower section here that was described as sand rock by the driller, and the units off to the right, what was described as bedrock by the driller is interpreted in this case as a quaternary deposit. And then we have the Tunnel City group down below that and the Wanawak sandstone below that. This was interpreted using gamma logs. So gamma logs are a critical piece of what we use. We have water well data, but then we also have this really quite amazing data set of gamma logs all over the state. But in Washington County, it was particularly useful for mapping the subsurface. So here's an example of gamma log. And right off the, so that uppermost portion is our unconsolidated deposit. And then on below that, we have the Tunnel City group. And below that, we have the Wanawak sandstone, all based on the gamma logs. And then this data goes back into County Well Index and is interpreted for those depth intervals as being the actual geology as recorded by the geologist. Okay, what else? Well, these well logs also have hydraulic information. So in this case, we have the open hole. First off, we have the data was completed, which is always important. But we also have some information about the casing. We see that it's completed down to 90 feet. So that's our open hole interval. We typically have some static water level information in it too, but I wanted to focus particularly in this case on an open hole. And the reason I put up this extra slide is that down the lower corner, so this is the cover page of the gamma log. When it was gamma logged, it was recorded that the static water level on this well was just above the land surface, about 2 feet. So we have an artesian condition in this well. So this is what it looks like. Here's our interpreted log off the gamma log. We've got Tunnel City group, and here's our open hole that stretches from just casing just into bedrock all the way down into the Wanawak. So again, if we take that artesian condition, and I don't have examples to show of the hydro flow meter logging that we've done over the number of years, but part of what we've been trying to do with these units is to characterize their hydraulic properties also. In this case, we'd expect to see upflow because the lower portion of the Tunnel City group is a confining unit, and that those artesian conditions are likely coming out of the Wanawak down below it. Okay, so back to our atlas. Here's our database plate. That well I was just showing you is an Afton water supply well for the Afton Alps ski hill. So this is where that is located. And so we want to go through some of the other symbols on this map to talk about what those data represent. So the first case, I'm going to introduce you to another data set, which is part of the atlas, is called the Quaternary Data Index. This is an in-house database that we're using for mapping, and it was a way to first start collecting engineering borings for logs. So in this case, instead of an engineering boring, we have a bucket auger. So this is just simply the geologist going out and digging with a bucket auger and recording his data. So this is Gary Meyer, who is the author of the Surficial Geology and Quaternary Stratigraphy in Washington County. And the record for the bucket auger shows a couple feet, 2.5 feet of loess and silt. So this gets recorded everywhere where you see one of those sort of pink crosses. In addition to that, you see a bunch of these data lining up along the roadways. These would be engineering borings either from Minnesota Department of Transportation or from the Wisconsin, or excuse me, the Washington County Highway Department. So we want to look at an example of one of those. This is a soil boring. So if you're familiar with these, again, most of you have seen these in engineering reports. That same data that you would see in an engineering report is recorded into this database also. So the depth of detail that you would get from an engineering boring is part of what we're trying to include as the data sets that go into the atlas. All these red crosses, pink crosses. These are passive seismic stations. So what's passive seismic? It's a way to get subsurface data, primarily depth to bedrock. We clustered them in this particular area because of a bedrock valley that moves down through this portion of Washington County. It's an area where there's a PFC site of interest. But before we go there, I had to explain passive seismic. So here's a picture of passive seismic. And if you didn't notice it, down the lower center there, there's a little yellow box right there, okay? That little yellow box is a Trimino unit, and this is actually what is collecting passive seismic data. I won't be able to explain to you how it works, except to say that you put it on the ground, and it picks up resonant seismic frequencies, so both horizontal and vertical, and based on the ratio of those two, I think of it kind of like a tuning fork, right? So you, ultimately it picks up what the resonant frequencies are going on from the land surface down to some impenetrable surface, in this case, the bedrock surface. And it actually works pretty well. So the resolution on this could be maybe 25% error, but it's oftentimes better than that. So for our purposes, being able to go out and use passive seismic for getting information on depth of bedrock, it's very useful. In this case, we were able to do a number of profiles across that bedrock valley and get depth of bedrock information to help with the mapping. So clearly there's some advantage to this. You lose a little in your resolution, but on the other hand, the cost is relatively minimal. It takes one person in about 30 minutes, so a lawn chair, to sit and wait for it to collect its data and then move on. So, sorry? Yeah, so it really depends on what that unconsolidated material is. So typically these units are calibrated by having water well data. I think for as far as depth go, we've recorded up to maybe 200 feet or deeper. Yes, getting nods from the MGSers. Okay, so about, it works fairly well in the Paleozoic because typically you have a nice signal on top. If you have a lot of till on top of that bedrock, it can get a little muddled. Okay, so here are those crosses, and this is the soil, the borings that run pretty much parallel with the bedrock valley. And this is the resulting bedrock topography. So in this case, Julia Steinberg at MGS was able to map this bedrock valley in quite a bit of detail. In particular, down where it takes a little right-hand turn to the east a little bit was the area in particular that was of interest, and this is the type of resolution we can get out from that. Okay, so we have a bedrock valley, a very deep bedrock valley, and cuts all the way down to the Jordan. We'll see that in just a second. But before we get to that, I want to talk about what's in the valley. And this would be Gary Meyer's mapping of quaternary stratigraphy. So we'll use the valley as an example of what those data sets look like. If we start adding in surfaces, now these are raster surfaces of tops and bottoms of till units. I'm just going to show you some till tops. In this case, we've got a lower loamy till, and there's just a little patch of it right showing up in the valley, right there. All right. And then on top of that, we have a series of tills that are all northeast provenance. They're coming out of the superior, with the superior lobe, and a series of advances. There's one, two, three, four, five. Till units that are within that. Now, what I'm not showing you in here are the intervening sand bodies within that valley. So we are mapping both tops, Gary in this case is mapping tops and bottoms of each of these till units, but also the intervening sands also have tops and bottoms. So this is how we're handling the heterogeneity within the quaternary deposits. The idea is that each of those tills will have a different texture. So a sandy loam to a loam, maybe have a different permeability. This will be the connection that the DNR will be using as they start to develop further on their subsurface sensitivity mapping. And as far as sand and gravel goes, we consider those all high permeability. So in this case, the model sand is sand. All right, so here's the cross section that cuts across that valley. And these are the units as they appear on the cross section. So each of those till units, again, have tops and bottoms and rasters, but in this case, they're three-dimensional in the sense they have a two-dimensional distribution. So for any given spot in the county, you'd be able to get the sequence of sands and tills down to bedrock. Okay, so here's the land surface. This is Gary's map of the same area, mostly sand and gravel. Colors are a little washed out, but basically the material on top is all sand and gravel, which we saw on the top of the cross section. The other thing I wanted to point out on this slide is that the base is a LIDAR-based hillshade, a relief map, which may get talked about today or may not. I just wanted to mention it in passing since we use it so often now, we take it for granted. It's really a remarkable data set, and it covers all of Minnesota. In this case, for the glacial mappers, it's like getting a pair of glasses, all of a sudden seeing things that they hadn't seen before, and also to be able to map at the detail of that elevation model is really important. So our products now are getting mapped to that level of detail where we're getting the elevations correct with the map unit, which is critical if you want to start doing surface water, groundwater modeling, for example, and you want to get your units correct to the elevation. So this is, again, a really remarkable data set. Okay, so if we take all the quaternary material off, we get to the bedrock. And again, this valley cuts all the way down to the Jordan. It's a very narrow valley. It's only less than a mile wide, many places less than that. And we're looking at Jordan as a thin yellow in the middle of the valley, then the Prairie du Chien in blue, St. Peter and Platteville on top of that. All right, so the bedrock map. This is, again, typically what we've produced in all our atlases, but I wanted to call your attention to an additional column here of hydrostratigraphic properties. So this started out a number of years back when we started looking at the hydraulic properties of these rocks and we wanted to represent them in an atlas. Okay, so we've got these confining units that appear. A lower Prairie du Chien group is considered a confining unit, shown in tan. You'll also notice on there a little black squiggly mark on there, that's a fracture. What we consider hydraulically active bedding plane fractures. In this case, they occur at distinct stratigraphic intervals commonly, so we feel that they're mappable. This is part, again, of mapping the heterogeneity within these units. Next one down is the St. Lawrence and Lower Jordan. Again, you see the same horizontal squiggly lines, and the fact that we have not only confinement within the St. Lawrence, but also within the Lower Jordan. In addition to that, it didn't show it, or at least it didn't show it in me, unless I have it out of order, but I wanted to show you some vertical fracture terminations within the St. Lawrence also. We'll talk a little bit more about that in this talk, but I also want to do a plug for our lightning talks with Tony Runkle at 4 o'clock. He's going to talk about a little bit more about the Afton borehole, which again, we'll see in just a second. At any rate, this whole issue of being able to map vertical fractures and how they relate to hydraulic head is an important aspect of where we're going with hydrostratigraphy, and I want to highlight that. There they are. So vertical fracture terminations are these little red lines that are coming in, and they are significant in terms of head differences. And so again, if you get all the way to the end of the day at 4 o'clock, please tune in, and Tony will be talking more about some of the more detail we work on this project. Okay. Back to the bedrock maps. So these surfaces are important because they really set the stage for all of our hydrostratigraphic mapping of the subsurface. And I wanted to highlight them again, just because Washington County is sort of it's a showcase of what these surfaces can do. So again, this is Julia Steinberg's work here. This is the top of the Jordan. So we have elevations at the top of the Jordan. And what you'll notice down the lower southeastern portion of the county is a significant change in elevation. So this is a fault block. And there are a number of fault blocks within a sort of a major uplift. So in terms of the procedures that we are working out to get rasters to be able to represent sharp fault boundaries, it had been worked out a number of years back with the second round of the Scott County Atlas, but this one was really sort of the test to see how well it would work. And again, Julia's produced some really nice surfaces. I wanted to also highlight the fact that in this case, the Prairie du Chien thins out as you go up to the northern portion of Washington County, which again is important that these surfaces are not simply just stacked layer cake maps, that they require that the geologists also be able to account for thinning and disappearing of surfaces. Andrew Retzler, another MGS mapper, is running into this right now in Hennepin County where Prairie du Chien disappears. So this is what we end up with, is a fairly high resolution representation of the tops and bottoms of each of these stratigraphic units. So starting from the bottom is the Mount Simon, the Eau Claire, Wanawak, Tunnel City Group, St. Lawrence, Jordan, lower portion of the Prairie du Chien, so this is an Oneonta top, Shakopee top, St. Peter, Platteville, Decorah. So that gives us the framework of the bedrock in elevation. And to highlight that, at least in terms of the detail of the resolution, I wanted to talk about the Afton borehole again. So you see it as a little dot down there near Afton. This was a site where we installed a multi-level port system to measure in detail changes in hydraulic head over a portion of the St. Lawrence. So the study was specifically targeted to look at the St. Lawrence formation. So there it is. That's a packer up within the casing, within the Jordan. As we get down into the actual St. Lawrence, now we're looking through the Jordan into the St. Lawrence. There's our St. Lawrence formation. And again, I show you this because it's kind of cute, but also the fact that it shows the level of resolution, the detail that we have in these raster surfaces. So we're capturing, in this case, the seven intervals that come in between the St. Lawrence formation. We were able to break down hydraulic head within that unit. And again, this gets back to this issue of being able to map within our stratigraphic boundaries to be able to get at what's actually inside these units. Okay, next one down. Bedrock outcrop. So we show on the database plate all our bedrock outcrop. And so I want to show you, again, kind of a over-the-top detailed version of that by looking at outcrop. So this is the Platfill Formation over by the U of M campus. A lot of the work that we've been doing lately is to be able to map secondary porosity and permeability within these rocks. So we could map by digitizing things like contacts, in this case between the Magnolia and the Hidden Falls, which it turns out is an important hydrostratigraphic contact. Okay, in addition to that, we can map vertical fractures, where those fractures terminate. So the termination of the fractures is related to the development of this particular horizon as being hydraulically active. But when you're working off of cross-sections, when you're working off of photos like this, you have a distortion problem, right? So if we want to get the contact of the Hidden Falls with the Mifflin down below it, that's the lower red line, or if we want to capture those vertical fractures up above, we're not quite sure what we're looking at, again, because we're looking at it straight on. Okay, so this outcrop, although it looks like we're standing right next to it, we're about 30 feet off the ground, so as if you were standing on scaffolding looking at the outcrop, when indeed there's that same pipe. This is being flown around by a drone at the University of Minnesota, which I think is just really fun, all right? So we've got a camera mounted on a drone that you can look at the outcrop, and again, the detail that's available on that is extraordinary. It's as if you were right up at the outcrop face. And not only that, you're looking directly at it, which is essential for what we're trying to do in terms of mapping fractures. Okay, so back to our flight. This outcrop in particular is attractive because it's so clean. There's very little vegetation here. There are clear joint faces through the entire unit. It has pretty much everything we want, except it's 30 feet up in the air. So this thing flies around, takes a whole bunch of photos, and we end up with an image that, if I can get it to run, that through photogrammetry, whatever, you can put the image together into a three-dimensional piece. So let's hopefully get it. There we go. All right, so what do we have? If we get this data into a three-dimensional data set, which you're doing right when you do this type of process, we're able to not only get the position of these fractures, but also their orientation. So the joint sets that are available in this image are important. And ultimately, what we can produce out of that. So here's a slide, the lower right-hand side, I don't know if you can see that, but there's actually a wire mesh now associated with that data. So again, it's a three-dimensional data set that we're producing. The goal of this project is specifically on the Platfill to be able to map in three dimensions over the campus, where we also have hydraulic data. What's the distribution of fractures, both horizontal and vertical? So this is how we're going to do it data-wise. So not appearing as anything directly on the atlas, but again, as with the hydrostratigraphy that we include on the atlas, this is the type of information of where we're going with this type of data. We see no restrictions on geologic mapping of the subsurface just based on memory. So as computer memory increases, we can add as much detail as we want, right? So that's really where we're headed with this. As an example of an application, I wanted to show you some More data from Washington County. So this is PFC data, PFBA specifically. So this is also an amazing data set. This is from Ginny Yingling in the Department of Health. Is Ginny here today? Okay. Well, Ginny has been working on this project for a number of years. And the nice thing about this data set is that it's collected over time. In this case, I won't be showing time, but I did want to show its distribution relative to these bedrock surfaces. So here's top of Jordan, and the green dots are the PFBA detects. I should mention also that this type of data set, besides being so thorough and complete, is amazing too because, again, PFCs are an ideal tracer. They don't react with anything, and we have inadvertently a really nice data set for tracing groundwater movement over a very big area. So from our perspective, we're interested in how it falls within the bedrock. So adding in the base of the Prairie du Chien shows that a lot of those dots are still there. There are a few that are down to the Jordan. Here's the Shakopee. Here's the St. Peter. So if we rotate that around, now we're back to the Jordan top again. We can see how these samples are stratified. Here's bottom of Oneota, bottom of Shakopee, bottom of St. Peter. So being able to take this information, at least in this case of a tracer, and be able to follow the path in three dimensions is kind of where we're going at. So you could take an application, if you're doing a groundwater model, use the chemistry as an independent tracer of groundwater movement, and in many cases, if the samples are over time, of time of travel also. It's a way of building the conceptual model for these data that we think is where these data sets are going to go. All right, so what's this? This is the elevation of recent water in the Rochester area based on chloride data. So these are Rochester Public Utility wells and their chloride data. And what I'm showing is their elevation below an elevation of 870 feet, which is the natural discharge elevation of the Zumbro River. So what we're interested in here is the distribution of chloride at depth as determined by elevation from city wells, in this case the city of Rochester. So we've jumped out of Washington County, we're down in Olmsted County, but I want to use this as an illustration of a point we were just touching on, which is how these things change through time. Okay, so here's 1981 RPU chloride, here's 2011, so same wells measured, and the elevation now is extended of recent waters as marked by chloride above 2 parts per million has expanded out quite a bit. It's also a little bit deeper. To put it in context, here's the top of the Jordan, okay? So what's happened this? You can see where the yellow is sort of truncated, that these units have expanded within the Jordan formation within the central part of the Rochester metropolitan area. So again, we're seeing through time how that change has taken place. So again, to put it in broader context and also to help you see where you are. Oops, not yet. This is chloride data from post-1999 from all wells in Olmsted County. So chloride levels above 2 parts per million in the Olmsted County. And in this case, 2 parts per million is a significant cutoff because we recognize that now by looking at a lot of these data in the Paleozoics in southeastern Minnesota, that 2 ppm is the natural background level, and above that is most likely anthropogenic. Okay, so this is what the distribution looks like for that. There it is in context. So a number of those wells now, this recent waters are down into the Jordan. So now hopefully we'll get some idea of where we're at. Oh, not yet. So here's a chloride trend, just again to show changes through time. So Olmsted County and Rochester have been very good about resampling wells. The only other county in Minnesota that's really done this really well is Dakota County. Anybody from Dakota County here today? Okay. So the data set that Dakota County has put together is very similar, that they've sampled wells over time repeatedly, in that sense are able to look at changes of water through time. And you can only do that with chemistry or some sort of tracer like that. We actually can see the distribution of these chemicals. So if you're building a groundwater model and you're trying to do a transient model, you have to calibrate the head for your model purposes, but your conceptual model has to be driven by this type of data where you can actually see how things are changing with time. Okay, so back to our model. This is the Prairie du Chien on that same unit. That's the St. Peter. Glenwood, Platteville, Decorah. So you can see where you're at now. Rochester is in that central area, surrounded down to the Prairie Chain is the first bedrock, and this horseshoe of these younger bedrock around the sides. So if you're familiar with Rochester to Decorah edge, this is the setting. But ultimately, if we go back to that chemistry, we're seeing this is the Decorah again for spatial reference, that the Decorah, that the elevated chloride is primarily where Decorah is not first bedrock, but it also exists back underneath that Decorah edge a little bit too. So how does that get there? These are all questions that you have to ask as you're building your conceptual model. Okay, how am I doing on time? All right, the last set of data I want to talk about are county atlas related in the sense of border problems. All right, so here we are in Washington County, and there's White Bear Lake. Okay, so this again is the classic problem of doing a study and the data that you want is not continuous over your area of interest. So this would be the classic example of that. Washington County, again, our current atlas is 2016. Ramsey County, the first iteration of Ramsey County was 1992. We don't have surfaces. We weren't doing them back in 1992. So we don't have a resolution to this problem except to say that we are working on it. But part of what this border issue pointed out was we also had issues with the quaternary deposits and that we also had not mapped those. And where there are time differences, we need to handle that in some fashion. So this process of working out the quaternary and unconsolidated deposits actually started with a project with the Met Council, and where we were looking at being able to produce quaternary sediment models where we didn't have any atlas data. So I want to show you an example of that, and we're going to jump up to Hubbard County and Straight River Watershed, where we also have atlases either completed or underway. So we've got the Becker County Atlas, 2016, and the Wadena County Atlas, 2016. But much of that watershed, Straight River watershed, is in Hubbard County, which is currently under construction. So how do we do that? How do you do that if you're asked to model that? Well, part of what we worked out, and I want to show you an example of, is this is how we create these surfaces. So there's this bottom of the surface, the bottom of the surface in Becker County of the surficial sand, and then the same in Wadena County. And then these cross-sections is how we build them. So the geologist goes through cross-section by cross-section, identifying the bottoms of units. And they're located, in this case, every kilometer. And this is what's going on in Hubbard County right now. So what do we do? Well, we can use the water well data to interpolate between points. And the reason we do this is because now we can get the geologists in their hands immediately, sort of a really quick and dirty example or estimate or a look at what the subsurface elevations are of sand bodies. So if you run histograms on by township over there, what you see are sort of the typical elevations where sand bodies occur. And down below Park Rapids, you can see this bimodal distribution of elevations. So this is clearly what we're picking up out of county well indexes is a buried sand, or at least one buried sand unit. Okay, so if we look at a cross section there, highlighted by that line right across that lower section of Hubbard County, this is what the data would look like. So here's our cross section that the geologist is starting with. And on top of that, we have the interpolated sand model. So you can see the buried sands that are down in the lower section of there are pretty well represented, and these are highlighted as likelihood of sand. But again, it's qualitative, but again, it gives a first pass on the on what the distribution of subsurface sand might be. So given the atlas procedures that we're going through now and the rate we're trying to go through them, we think this will greatly help the geologists in trying to put together a subsurface model. Okay, so back to our atlas plate. I want to highlight one last piece to the atlases, if you weren't aware of it, is the Geologic User's Guide. Geologic User's Guide was put together by Dale Siderholm at the MGS, and it's a really useful tool. In the table of contents, you can just see there's first just some background for the general user. Again, for many of the people that use atlases are not familiar with geology or hydrogeology or groundwater in general. So there's nice sections on here on what the data are and what these systems do and what they how they work, and then a section on how you can apply the various pieces of the atlas to those projects. Current mapping status. So back in 2007, funding for the atlas program started to increase and then has increased even more. The goal of the legislature is to have the entire state mapped, and so we've been working furiously to try and keep up with that, and it's coming along quite well. So at this time, there are 38 counties that have complete Part A's, 10 new atlases, and 2 revisions that are currently underway. So we looked at a revision in Washington County. The first Washington County atlas was 1990. A lot of these, well, atlases are coming back because there's so much more data. Olmsted County is going through a revision right now, as is Hennepin. So of the 38 counties without an atlas, 7 have committed to participation. So we're up to our ears in atlases, which is a good thing. In conclusion, so physical setting, we want to get data into a suitable model for format for modelers and water planners. The total cost of an atlas is typically roughly around $400,000, with funding provided by the the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund. So pretty much everything that I've showed you through this talk has been funded by the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund, administered by the LCCMR since its start. They've been a huge atlas supporter. In addition to that, the Clean Water Legacy Amendment also has money that goes towards atlases. The county contribution now for a county geologic atlas is in-kind contribution. They do the well locating for getting the data in. So that aspect of it has been taken out, but that's how it's set. So it's still on a cooperative basis with counties, where counties show an interest in having atlas done. And again, that's what our final map looks like. And I have some time for questions. Okay. Cool.
So we have time for a couple questions, but I'd also encourage you, Bob will be back serving on the panel after lunch. And so if you have additional questions, you can ask them as part of the panel or within Pigeonhole. But if anyone has any burning questions right now, we do have time for a couple.
Thanks, Bob.
Yep, you're welcome.
I know one of the recent products that MGS has put out is this great bedrock map statewide, where you can peel away the layers of the bedrock. Right. Is something like that visualized for the quaternary in Minnesota for the whole?
Oh, yeah.
Or not so much?
You brought up a good point, and I should have had some slides to show that. Yeah, so one of the huge efforts that's gone on at MGS over the last 5 years or so, at least, has been to codify all our geologic representations, in other words, our unit names of quaternary deposits. That's well underway. There are statewide cross sections that have been completed, and I'm sorry I didn't bring copies of those to show you, but it'll be basically a replacement for the quaternary map that you're all familiar with, the Hobbs and Goebel map. But in addition to that, we'll have these units all defined as continuous names across the state.
Are you planning on having an expanded geophysics program to complement the borehole data?
Not yet, not now.
Is that in the works or part of the plan?
We haven't specifically planned on it, but we're certainly interested in getting additional geophysical data. And again, that has to do with the type of data that's readily available and stuff that we could afford to do. But yeah, we think that would be a nice addition to our quaternary mapping for sure. Okay, thank you.